Education Finance Committee will come to order. Welcome, committee members and guests, members of the public. Let's see. Representative Seltzer, would you like to move our minutes from the April 6th meeting?
Madam Chair, I move our minutes from the April 6th meeting.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the minutes from the April 6th meeting, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Minutes are adopted. Thank you very much, Representative Seltzer. Members, because I want to make sure that we give ample time to our testifiers today, and we are very pleased to have the commissioner with us, I'm going to first move a very brief bill. It's in your packets, House File 718. It's just a technical corrections bill. There is a DE1 amendment in your packet. So I would move that House File 718 be referred to the General Register. And then I would move the DE1 amendment to House File 718. And because it is some technical corrections, I will ask Mr. Strom if he wants to explain what they are.
Madam Chair, members, the DE1 amendment clarifies some parts of the general education revenue statute. It basically removes obsolete references in each of the four subdivisions listed.
All right, so we're just removing some obsolete language from the statutes. Any questions? All right, seeing none, all in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, amendment is adopted. And now to House File 718 as amended. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor of House File 718 as amended, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right. House File 718 is approved and on its way to the General Register. Thank you very much, members. And with that, Commissioner, please welcome. Today we are going to hear a testimony on the Governor's Supplemental Budget for Education. And so we're very pleased to have the Commissioner and Mr. Uni with us. For members' information, I did introduce the governor's budget. Happy to do that. And there is an amendment in your packets that the department has asked, just some cleanup language in that. Unfortunately, because the bill was referred to rules, we don't officially have this in front of us, so I can't move the amendment, but so we can take care of that as a later time. But just for informational purposes, it is here. So with that, welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Brenda Caselius, Commissioner of Education. Thank you, Madam Chair, for inviting me here to speak. I also want to thank Representative Erickson for working very closely with my team around the policy bill to get some of our technical changes in her policy bill. I will speak very briefly and broadly about our goals and what we were doing this year in terms of priorities for the governor and lieutenant governor around this year's supplemental budget. Just reminding folks that it is a supplemental budget year this year, and the governor really came out when he talked about his budget of being fiscally responsible. So the investments that we are making today are small investments that we think will help us accelerate our goals of the 90% graduation rate with no student group being below 85%. And also accelerate our achievement gap closure. So I will just briefly speak about some of the components, high level, since you don't have the bill right in front of you, on what we are looking to prioritize this session and the amounts attached to those in the 16 or 17 school year and then the tails in 18-19 school years. So for education specifically, in looking at the early learning package, what we did was look at some supports that not only are here in the ed budget, but also in the DHS budget around CCAP reforms and additional funding for CCAP. So I just wanted to make sure that some of our early learning investments are broader across agencies with home visiting and the children's cabinet. And I know Dr. Ellinger is here. We'll speak to some of that later, as well as DHS will also speak to that. I think Assistant Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner Jim Koppel will also speak to the DHS budget and how that impacts children and families. So a strong focus on children's and families, as well as graduation rates, raising those, and then closing achievement gaps. So in early learning, specifically in the ed budget, we see voluntary pre-kindergarten. This is voluntary, similar to what we were proposing last year, but very different in that it's a capped program at $25 million to grow to $40 million in 18 and then $60 million in 2019. It is for a mixed delivery system for school districts to choose and work through implementing high-quality standards for early learning, and then school districts will receive 0.6 funding within their schools. They only have to have a minimum of 350 hours for voluntary pre-kindergarten. We also hear broadly across the state that we have a teacher workforce shortage. I know that you've also heard this and had testimony and speaking with your local school districts. And we brought forward last year a teacher workforce proposal in the governor's budget, and I'm happy to see this year that there is good support for a teacher workforce package. So we are proposing $12.4 million to really look at four key areas: American Indian education teachers, a program that the Board of Teaching will do to accelerate licensure for teachers who are currently licensed, called the CAPS program, with a Certificate of Advanced Professional Study, as well as the granting program for new people and people who are mid-year professionals going into wanting to become teachers, tuition support and help, and then also paraprofessionals who are in our classrooms already who love our kids and just really don't earn enough in salary to be able to go back to school. So we think that those four key programs will help us to get about another 1,200 professionally licensed teachers into our schools. So we're very excited about teacher workforce. Also, as you know, in 2011, we passed a really strong bipartisan teacher evaluation system, and we have worked with our unions alongside to implement that program in our school boards and school administrators, and we think we have a pretty successful teacher evaluation program going on in our schools. The unfortunate thing is that if you're a QCOMP district, you have resources in which to administer your teacher evaluation program, but in other districts they don't have as much funding in order to administer those programs. So in 2013 there was some additional funding given to districts for teacher development evaluation, and so we are proposing to do similar type of program with teacher development, which is $10 million, which would give one-time costs to school districts to implement their teacher development and evaluation systems. So then Help Me Grow is another program that gets a lot of support to help navigate the systems for our at-risk families and children. And so this will help them engage with state government, community partnerships, and get the resources that they need to help their children grow and thrive. Full-service community schools has been something this body has invested in previously at a much smaller level. We have about four schools that have been working on full-service community schools. It's where we get all of the support systems into some of our high-need schools to be able to coordinate services for families, and we're proposing $2 million in full-service community schools. PBIS implementation, you may have been following the news. I know there's some bills being implemented or being proposed on behavior and looking at how do we positively reward schools and help get them some additional training around creating good school cultures in which children thrive and learn and grow in. And positive behavior intervention supports is really the number one national program to do that. Matter of fact, I have really deep understanding of PBIS because we implemented it in Memphis, Tennessee when we removed corporal punishment there and replaced it with positive behavior intervention systems, and we saw a significant drop in suspensions and behaviors and improvement in school cultures when this is implemented. And as I visited the 44 four and four time reward schools, we saw most of those schools using PBIS or something very similar like responsive classroom within their school communities. Restricted procedures work group. This is work that we were doing with Olmsted work to continue to look at ways to reduce restrictive procedures in schools. And so this is $1 million for restrictive procedures. Last year, we were looking at funding the Metro Deaf School so that they could have preschool students. I know that they're here as well today to testify. And we're hoping that we can get this done. It's $69,000. It's a very small ask, looking to be able to allow for our youngest deaf and hard of hearing citizens to be able to access preschool at this very wonderful school. Just came from a press event with the Lieutenant Governor and Governor regarding GED. Because of our meeting targets with the Department of Economic Development, we had some additional bonus money for meeting those targets. So what we decided to do as part of that bonus money was to give the GED for free. And as many of you know, the GED was changed in 2014, and we saw a significant drop-off of people actually taking and attaining the GED. And so what we found now is that we've had about 800 test takers, but when we gave it for free this past month, we had 1,800 test takers. So we know that this $120 is a barrier to people taking the GED. So the more barriers we can remove, the greater opportunity we create. So we had two wonderful speakers there today who have been able to take advantage of this, of the new GED and this new funding, and also take advantage of the funding that the legislature already provides, the $125,000, and then we're asking for an additional $120,000 in FY17 to begin to see, is this truly a big barrier for some of our families in accessing and passing the GED? Our online IEP system is something we've been working on several years now to try to reduce paperwork for teachers by having a streamlined system of the required forms that are required by federal law, and that teachers can quickly have information automatically populated. They're easier to transfer that information from district to district with, of course, the right kind of permissions. So this is a way to provide reduction in paperwork for our special ed teachers, and also ease and quicker communications among school districts and parents. We have a problem with our IT system. It was built in 1974 on Cobalt, and because of our recent retirements, we are getting to the point of not having anyone at the agency who still has the knowledge in order to work our old IT system. And there's just not that many people in the industry who still work on systems from 1974. As you know, systems change on your phone almost every 6 weeks. And just imagine what it's like to have, you know, the entire billions of dollar education budget coming out of a system built in 1974. We are asking for $4.3 million to replace that system. It's one-time funding, we think that it's at a critical stage and it really needs to be funded. Commissioner Baden is here and will speak to that as well from Minute. Licensure via portfolio, as you know, this is a hot topic. We collect fees for the time that it takes to actually approve portfolios through the Board of Teaching and the Minnesota Department of Education. And we are collecting these fees, but because of a provision within the law, we're not able to actually spend the money. So this is just a provision to allow us to spend the money. Alternative compensation. This is one-time funding of $240,000 to allow two schools to enter into QCOMP that were not entered into QCOMP due to charter schools who had increased their enrollment due to grade expansion. And so we had sent out approvals for them and then had to come off of those approvals because of the cap on QCOMP. And we wanted to be sure that they were able to be funded, and that's $240,000. And there's some technical changes in the policy bill as well that will help us not get into this situation again when enrollments shift either in our charters or traditional public schools. The Board of Teaching operating adjustment is $30,000 in 16, $77,000 in 17, and $83,000 in 18. Clarification of special education tuition billing. There's some policy and technical fixes that Dr. Melcher can answer once you have the bill in front of you, but that's carrying no costs. So as you can see, it's a very reasonable budget. Overall, it's about $60.8 million this year, and we believe that the priorities on helping every kid get a great first start, expanding choice for families in terms of how they choose early learning services and a mixed delivery system and building that out, as well as investing in our teachers and then investing in some of the work to ensure our students who haven't graduated can actually earn their GED. Just wanted to give you one interesting fact on GED, and because our graduation rates have increased so much to 82% over the past 5 years, and it was at 75% in 2010, we had 18,000 students that were non-graduates in 2010. And in 2015, we only had 12,000 non-graduates. So we see an increase of 6,000 graduates. And this is really good news for Minnesota. So as we continue to increase our graduation rates, we will continue to see a decrease in the amount of students needing to take a GED. But since we had poor graduation rates for so many years, it's really important that we give this step up to all of our non-graduates who maybe didn't graduate and who are adults now who want to enter the workforce. So I thank you for giving me the time today, and I'd be glad to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Did you have other testifiers from the department or?
Not from the department.
No. Okay.
Very well.
All right. Yeah, we do have three other testifiers from the administration. I'll pose to the committee right now. Would you like to ask questions of the commissioner from education before we bring up representatives from DHS, or is there any preference? Doesn't look like it. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome, Commissioner. How many who take the GED the first time pass it? Do you have that data?
Our passage rate is about 84% in Minnesota, and the passage rate nationally is 74%.
Thank you.
I'm not sure if that's on the first or second time, Representative Erickson, but I can certainly get that to you. Most pass it, I think, on the first time because they take a practice test first, and then our ABE centers have very good assurances that they're going to pass it before they actually have them sit for it.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Erickson.
Commissioner, the funding, though, is for just one setting. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, that is correct, that the funding is for one set for the first attempt at this point.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and welcome, Commissioner, and thank you for all your work. Anytime you add money into preschool, I think that's certainly the way to go, and I know your efforts to close the achievement gap is paramount in your goals. Just a little clarification on this, however, on the funding source. It sounds like to have a universal pre-K, you have to have 350 hours minimum.
Yeah.
And then the max that you can be funded is at 0.6,
right.
But that's not at 350. That would be at 510 hours. When I look at Section 7, that's some clarification. And Section 7, which is, hang on here, page 9, starting at 9.1, it talks about a 9.3. It says, counted as the ratio of the number of hours of instruction to 850 times 1.0, but not more than 0.6 pupil units. And so is everything into the 850, so you need 510 hours to get the 0.6, and 350 hours, if I did my math, you'd qualify for 0.41. Am I correct? Or I mean, just that's a little confusing for me. So
Commissioner. Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, I'm going to let Adosh Uni speak to the provisions, the technical provisions that you're bringing.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, thanks for the opportunity to answer the question. Yes, you're correct. So the span of 510 hours to 850 hours would be capped at 0.6. And then if you look, yes, the 0.412 would be awarded for the floor of 350 hours. And then a 0.5 would be 425 hours.
Gotcha. So, Madam Chair.
Representative Barrett.
So, by correct, so everything is based on the 850.
Yes.
It's ratio to decide, but you need at least 350 hours to qualify for the program. So.
Yes,
Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, yes, that's correct.
All right. Thank you very much.
Questions? Representative Mulray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I'm trying to see exactly. Maybe you can help with. I'm looking at your handout, trying to find the exact language. So I have two questions under Article 5, Section 1. In your handout summary, it says requires MDE to annually review the system performance and impacts. Why? Or is there similar language in other bills that would have the other two departments connected? Also annually reviewing that and reporting? Otherwise, I think that all three departments should be reviewing it. And then in your bullet point number three, is that getting near the thing that I've been trying to get the department to do, which is to look at other risk factors other than poverty? Because if you look at all of the Robert Anda or any of the other, whether it's the Search Institute, different ones, all say, you go, Bruce Katz even, who was Obama's czar on revitalization of inner cities, that there's poverty by itself isn't a factor as much as the concentration in inner cities or reservations. Certain places in rural Minnesota are the same way, and that those other stress factors are the ones that really matter, whereas poverty in a county that it's spread out, maybe Todd or something, is not quite as important. So is that, I can't find the exact language real quick, but on your bullet point, it kind of makes a reference to that. Is that what that's getting at, or just what?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Mulray, yes, I think the answer is yes to your question in that in the evaluation and the reporting, we are responsible, but we will absolutely work with the other agencies around that. For instance, with our early childhood system and even our children's cabinet with Help Me Grow, it's cross-agency with the Department of Health and with the Department of Human Services. And then your second question requiring all of the aspects that go in regardless of just poverty, we do look at multiple indicators as we're looking at youth development and supporting of our students. So I'm not certain exactly which indicators we'll have, but we'd be glad to work with you individually on that. See if we're addressing what it is you're asking about.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Additional questions? I have a couple of questions, Commissioner, and they're in no particular order of your bill. I'm sorry, I just jotted a couple of notes.
That's fine.
The positive behavioral intervention strategies, how is that administered? Is that a grant program out to specific districts who want to employ that, or how does that work specifically?
Madam Chair, it's both. I don't have department staff with me, but we do provide grants to school districts as well as we provide significant training at the agency and department. We have some federal funds because this is also seen as a best practice to reduce special education referral. So we've used some of that funding to also support this work.
Thank you. And then just a question on the IT, and I know we have talked also in meetings you and I have had about your the IT system and how very old it is. Just, you know, in the budget that was approved finally in June for the department, that there was a 2% increase for the overall department's operations. Was any of that money devoted to IT upgrades?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that any of the money was devoted to IT upgrades, and we did actually experience cuts to the agency. If you recall, we had $22 million cut out of our assessment budget, and we had additional cuts into academic standards. And so there just really isn't much agency budget to cover the kind of cost that we would need to cover. It's a $4.3 million ask to replace that system. It's a very old system, and transporting to a new system, it will be an expensive one-time cost, but it's not expensive compared to the amount of money we're putting out in our finance system, and we would not want to be making mistakes and then not having the personnel because they're retiring. I think this is a very urgent need. We wouldn't be here asking if this wasn't a very critical need for us right now, and it just cannot be covered with the agency budget.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I'm trying to recall, my memory is not great on this, but was this an official ask or part of the budget proposal going into last year's budget process?
This was not in part of it. We've actually had staff to be able to maintain the system, and because we've had lots of retirements, we're at that point now where we're anticipating even more retirements where we cannot continue to upkeep.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to follow up on your question, and if I'm incorrect in what I'm saying, please correct me. But my understanding is that MINUT is a part of the Department of Administration.
Yes.
And my question really is, why do you in the Department of Education ask for funding for technology? Why isn't the Department of Education administration asking for that?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I do have Commissioner Baden here with me, and he'd be glad to speak to it, and I'm not sure if he's on the testifying list or not, but he'd be glad to talk about it, and I actually think he's probably much better to talk about the risk that we are at in terms of the level of that technology and its capacity to handle such a large budget. So I don't know if Commissioner Baden, if you'd like him to come up now, or if you'd rather wait.
Well, he certainly is on the list. So why don't we see if there's any more questions for you, and then we'll bring the commissioner up.
Representative Murphy just informed me it's MMB, but the question still remains. You know, is why do we have these between different departments asking for the funding?
And I think it's a good question. Thank you, Representative Newton. Representative Quamp.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Concilius. Back when I was on the school board and chaired a seven-district ed district, there we had a situation of where there were more stringent requirements for graduation in some of the districts, and in the end of the junior year, if they were going to be short, a half credit, etc., they might open enroll into one of our other districts that didn't require that. I know with ACL and other programs, those that haven't been able to graduate on time actually have been able to graduate. And so I was wondering if any of the programs that have assisted the non-on-time graduation have helped alleviate the decrease, you know, the non-graduate number you said went down. Have any of these additional avenues assisted in making it possible for people to actually graduate?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I'm not, and Representative Quam, I'm not certain I know ACL. Do you mean ALC? ALC programs? Okay. I think, well, first let me clarify, our graduation requirements, actually, my former Commissioner Segrin in 2010 brought forward college and career ready graduation requirements, and this body made changes that are now in effect and were for the first time in effect for our 2015 class. And they are the highest, the most challenging requirements that have been actually been for any other graduating class. For instance, you have to take Algebra 2. and that was not required prior to the 2015 class. You have to have Algebra 1 in 8th grade, and that had to you have to master that and have completed that successfully. You have to take sciences, and you have to take chemistry and or physics. That was not required before. So there are additional graduation requirements that I think, you know, make it actually a little bit tougher for our graduates now because they're aligned to college and career ready. As to the question of ALCs, we can get you some more information on ALCs and their graduation rates. They're not good as we'd like them to be. I think that there's some effort there that we need to do to work more closely with our ALCs. They do make a difference for some kids, and that's a good thing. But that's an area that we need to definitely strengthen.
Representative Kwan. All right, thank you. Additional questions? And if not, I think we'll bring the additional testifiers. Thank you, Commissioner. If you're able to stay, I would invite you to in case another question may arise. But thank you and to Mr. Oney very much. All right, so I do have Assistant Commissioner Koppel from DHS and Commissioner Baden from Minute and Dr. Ellinger from Department of Health as well. All right, and while our testifiers are coming up, members, for your information, a corrected version of the summary of the governor's supplemental budget bill is handed out, as well as Ms. Johnson has prepared a spreadsheet which shows the changes the governor is proposing to our budget, a spreadsheet. So that has also been handed out to you for your information. All right, well, welcome, gentlemen, and I guess I'll let you draw straws or however you want to decide who goes first. If you please just introduce yourself before you provide your testimony, and welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Commissioner Thomas Baden of Minute Services, and I speak on behalf of the IT. And just want to let you know that we're partners with all 26 branch agencies and the 80 boards and commissions that we serve here as the technology partner for the state. And I'm here to support the commissioner and the agency with the $4.3 million ask. This is a component of the governor's overall cybersecurity package that he has put in the budget this year. This particular package, or this particular ask, has four discrete components. The first component is around mainframe replatforming. As the commissioner pointed out, the mainframe platform it comes from the 70s. Actually, there's components of the code that were actually written in the late 60s and were out of support in the early 70s. It's an application, and when we looked at our application portfolio this year, we looked at it and we just went, this can't wait. We have to minimally replatform this application and get us onto a server environment that we can patch and secure. Another component is around the updates to the Early Learning Scholarship Administrative Payment System, which the commissioner talked about as far as garnering some efficiencies on that front. Also, some additional updates to the Career and Technical Education Levy System, which doesn't date all the way back to the 70s, but it was written on Java version 1 in the late 1990s. We're now currently on Java version 8. Going on 9. Even version 8 has some security vulnerabilities. I'm very concerned about the cybersecurity aspects of this. The notion is to bring the software platform up to date so we can secure it. And last but not least, the fourth component of this is the identity and access management that protects the 40 websites for the Department of Education. The identity and access management protects all of those websites by putting agents on the websites and controls who has access to get in and out of them. The current platform was... I've been through this now with several different agencies. The current platform is out of support, and the code base that this has been written on is now, by the vendor, is completely updated, and therefore it's not just one of those things where we can convert into a newer version. We literally have to take the database and all the properties and all the website agents and move them into this modern platform. So it's $4.3 million. I think there's a high degree of urgency around it. It is also, though, really foundation and fundamental. I don't believe we're looking at anything extravagant here. It's really, for lack of a better term, some basic block and tackling around IT to at least get these systems to a point where they're less at risk.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Baden. Representative Newton, you want to renew your questioning?
Yes. Thank you, Commissioner. The question basically is, you're part of MMB and you do the IT, but I don't understand why some departments are also requesting funding for IT and it all isn't concentrated in the one department where you are with the Minute.
Commissioner Baden.
Madam Chair, actually we're a separate agency now. About 4.5 years ago, that went into legislation. So Minute is an independent agency now, and along with that, we're fully a chargeback organization. The way we're structurally set up financially, I think it's just right around 1% is actually a direct allocation. It's my core staff and a few security people that are direct allocated. Everything else is a chargeback type of model.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions for Commissioner Baden? All right, I think we'll move on, but a question may come to you yet, so you might want to just stay put. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Ed Ellinger, Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Health. I appreciate the opportunity to be before this committee, which I'm not before very often, and the opportunity to speak in support of the governor's 2016 budget. And I'm not here just solely as a representative of the health department, but also as the stakeholder in this work, as a pediatrician and a parent and a grandfather. And as a parent, you know, I'm grateful that my adult children have benefited greatly from the programs and services and policies that have given them the opportunities to be healthy and successful in life. I'm now working to assure that my four grandchildren, and perhaps someday great-grandchildren, and all of the children their age have similar opportunities that will impact their individual health and the health of our state for the next century and really beyond. As a pediatrician, I recognize the importance of healthy child development as important to an individual child's health. And as health commissioner, I'm here to acknowledge and underscore the fact that education policy and funding have tremendous implications for individual health and the health of our communities. Education is one of the major determinants of physical, emotional, and financial health on both an individual and a community level. That's why we, as partners in the Governor Dayton's administration, have begun an unprecedented effort to coordinate all state program activities that meaningfully impact the lives of Minnesota's young children. Research in early brain development indicates that experiences in the first few years of a child's life are the most critical and can have far-reaching consequences. The absence of or presence of safe, stable, and nurturing environments and relationships in children's lives will significantly determine the health and well-being, as well as their trajectory in school and throughout their lives. With that in mind, the governor's budget focuses a major portion of the state's surplus towards creating safe, stable, nurturing experiences and environments for pregnant and parenting families with young children through a coordinated effort at the Departments of Health, Human Services, and Education. Specifically for the Minnesota Department of Health, the governor's budget proposes expanding our existing evidence-based home visiting program to offer this high-value service to any pregnant and parenting teen in Minnesota. Evidence-based family home visiting is a two-generation approach that has been shown to be successful in mitigating adverse childhood experiences, decreasing rates of abuse and neglect, and changing the trajectory of the child and the family. Evidence-based home visiting, starting prenatally, has been shown to positively impact both parents and their children in the following areas: reducing maternal depression, improving parental and child graduation rates, improving rates of prenatal care and positive birth outcomes, increasing the time intervals between pregnancies, increasing breastfeeding and parenting skills, better connection of teen parents to important services like economic assistance, the WIC program, housing, and more. Our Minnesota Department of Health efforts will be supported by and work in conjunction with the investment in Help Me Grow that Commissioner Caselius talked about. That proposal helps parents secure the support they need through connections to resources that support healthy child development. In addition, the governor's voluntary pre-K proposal works to provide equitable access to quality pre-K across the state for families in areas that live in high poverty areas currently lacking high-quality choices. And the inclusion of the development for the development of full-service community schools, which will bring resources into the school environment, will support children and their families within the school environment and allow easy accessibility to services where neighborhood access may be limited. This will be great support for the health and well-being for children and will serve as a conduit to reach their full potential and help to build, enhance, and sustain a culture of health within a community. The Minnesota Department of Health is pleased to support the Governor's 2016 budget package, which we believe promotes equitable opportunities for pregnant and parenting families with young children to provide safe, stable, nurturing experiences and environments that will increase positive outcomes in health and development and provide thousands of Minnesota children with improved trajectories in school and in life and advance equity in our state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Ellinger. We actually have a question from Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Ellinger, specifically on the home visitor program, I have a bill in and it hasn't gotten a hearing to allow the home visitors to be also go to FFN caregivers, because many times the child is with one of them almost the entire day, and yet many of them do not have the training that comes with the home visitor program on how to help the child's brain develop. And so apparently it's not going to get a hearing here. Can you do that on your own, or can you, is that part of your request now that right now it's the department's home visitors only go to the parents, or if the FFN caregiver comes with the parents? What we need, and there's a lot of studies that show that, is the FFN caregivers need to have that same training, because many of them don't have. And so is that wrapped into this, or can it be, or exactly where are we on that?
Dr. Ellinger.
And Madam Chair and Representative Mullery, you bring up a really important point. So family, friend, and neighbor care is where most of the children are really seen on a regular basis during the day for child care. And that's an important environment for a lot of education and a lot of care and a lot of modeling. The home visiting program really is focused on parents. However, the department does do some education with daycare providers, and that's where we would really want to focus our efforts on, maybe not through the same public health nurse home visiting program, but with our child care consultation program to give them the support that is needed to really do good nurturing in those family, friend, and neighbor environments.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Ellinger, I know in other parts of the country, the home visitor program adds in those FFN, not just when the parents are there. And are you getting to enough of the little FFNs, maybe often one person and maybe one or two children, under what you're talking about, the provider education program? Or would we achieve a lot of them by also doing the home visitor, allowing them to help the FFN on their own?
Dr. Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I believe our efforts are insufficient in educating family, friend, and neighbor providers. And you know, that is a real deficiency in what we have as a state. Working, and we have inadequate resources even now to visit all of the teen parents. And that's what our proposal is, actually, to be able to first start and get at teen parents, so that every teen parent would have a public health nurse home visiting option. But to expand beyond that would take some additional resources. It would be something that we would be considering as we move forward.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. All right. I don't see any of the questions right now, so we'll turn to you, Assistant Commissioner Koppel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services in the Department of Human Services. And I will just briefly run through the initiatives that complement the Department of Education, Department of Health efforts to better address the needs of our youngest children and their families. So the early childhood piece of the governor's budget could go into four areas quickly. One, which doesn't impact this committee as much, is the bonding, but the governor has requested $20 million in bonding for early childhood facilities, so that's a fairly significant increase in the amount of money that we're bonding for these facilities, and this is in response to the need both from the $15 million that's dedicated to general operating bonds for school districts to be able to add classroom space or appropriate space for their early childhood programming, and also there's a $5 million general fund request as well, which would be directed toward Head Start, nonprofits, and tribal opportunities for the same early childhood development. Secondly, there is a federal block grant where we receive most of our money for our early childhood funding. This Child Care Development Block Grant was reauthorized, and we have the final draft regs have been out. We haven't seen the final regs, but the operating off of those draft regs, a good portion of the governor's budget is adapting to those new federal regulations. And the highlights of those is to really focus on the stability of child care for families. So we currently reauthorize a family every 6 months. This new federal regulation says to go for 12 months. And again, this is really for a family to be able to plan on having child care for a longer period of time, to not have their copay increase, to not have their hours change, depending on what minor changes happen at their employment. They will be guaranteed this 12-month eligibility standard, and then at the end of 12 months come in and reauthorize and update their records, etc. The largest piece of the budget is directed toward child care rates. Our child care rates have gone down fairly consistently for the last 15 years. 15 years ago, we were at the 75th percentile. And what that means is that we do market studies around the state, and we did them every year, update, so see what the market rates are. And then we look in each county and see what percent of providers are getting their rates reimbursed, 100% of their rate reimbursed. And 15 years ago, it was 75% of providers. That was what the statute recommended. Today, it's about 25% of providers get their rates reimbursed. So when you hear this 25th percentile, it's not that they're getting 25% of what they charge. It's really that only 25% of providers get the rates they charge. The governor's recommendation is to increase that to 50% so that half of providers would get what they're charging, and also to go to a more recent update, which would be 2016, and this is another federal requirement, which would go to the most recent market survey possible. So a 2016 market survey would update the actual rates being charged. The last one that we're operating under right now is 2011, so there's been that lapse as well. All of this is in an effort to really build a stable and strong early childhood system so that parents that are working are going to have consistent, high quality and child care, and that this occupation of early childhood is a real occupation, and you can make a living, and whether you're doing it as a family child care or whether you're center-based, we want that to be a profession that is so important to the development of our youngest children. The last thing I'll mention is there are also changes in the federal regulations that address licensing. We would be licensing child care providers annually. Again, 15, maybe it's 20, but a couple decades ago we were doing it annually. During some of our leaner years, that was one of the things we moved to every 2 years. So this would bring us back to the annual licensure of our child care providers. those are some of the highlights, and I stand for any questions.
Thank you. And Representative Mallory has some questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Three points. What did you decide on the issue that I brought up about, I work a lot with immigrant communities, and you were going to cut off at 3 months and not working again, and I worked with the trainers, the immigrant agencies, the community colleges, and they say often that they can't get somebody back trained for us. Some of these people just are really hard to train, and they can't get them into jobs that quick. Are you still stuck on the 3 months, or is there a way to make exceptions on that in certain cases?
Commissioner Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, I'm not sure I'm understanding your question, but I remember this conversation, and I'm trying to recall when there is a 3 month transition off of child care assistance, if you become ineligible from a work requirement or other, but I'm not quite sure what 3 months you're referring to.
You were going to have...
Representative Mallory.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. You were going to have that... I got into a big discussion when your staff was with me on this, that if they hadn't gotten another job after 3 months, then they were going to be cut off. And that's an enormous problem because we just are not able to get some of them trained again into an open job, and that's a big issue with certain people. So I had asked you to not have a chop-off line automatic, but that there be exceptions. Are we going to have exceptions on that or not?
Assistant Commissioner Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, I'll have to get back to you on that. I'll check and see.
Second, Madam Chair, the second,
Representative Mallory.
Second thing is I hope you are enlightened, like I've been pushing you for a few years to go to 75% L group. You're at 50% now. That's better than you were. But the third is parent aware? Right now we have an awful need in rural and in communities of color especially, and we need recruitment in those areas, training and rating, so that we can have rural kids and especially poor areas of kids of color getting the high quality. So I'm just wondering what's going on in that.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Mallory, the Parent Aware program continues to grow. We have right now about nearly 30% of CCAP, the child care assistance children, in Parent Aware rated programs. We are focusing and prioritizing rural. We want to have the breadth to be in every county, to have that ability to have high quality child care statewide. And we also want to focus on our communities of color and Native American populations to assure that they too will have high rated program options. As you know, this is a growing program. It has the funding we receive comes through the Department of Education, and Representative Loon has been very helpful. Thank you to helping that happen. And along with this is the last year we have we're spending down a race to the top dollar, so we're continuing to grow our parent aware providers, and we are continuing to prioritize those populations around the state. So I think we're going to continue to have good progress. We are constantly talking with providers and looking at how we can make that a better program and be more responsive and have more training available. All of those things, and specifically direct outreach into specific communities to assure more higher participation. I think we have been successful on many of those in the last year, and we'll continue to work on them.
Representative Mallory.
Madam Chair, and I should have thanked you beforehand for picking up what a different committee should have, and you saw the hole, and thank you for picking that up. I'm just wondering, Mr. Koppel, are you asking for what we all know is needed, additional funds in that?
Commissioner Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I don't get to do that personally, but so I would put it in the context of in the governor's budget this year, one of the big priorities was the block grant regulations and making sure that we conform to those and also improve our program, and secondly, dramatically increase reimbursement rates in order to attract and retain a quality workforce. So this year there is not additional money in the base of Parent Aware, but we have the spend down from the Race to the Top grant, as well as the money we received last year, which allows us to grow slightly and to maintain what we have. I do anticipate coming back here next year and perhaps having a more significant discussion around that issue.
No further questions.
Thank you, Representative Mullery. I do have a couple of quick questions, Commissioner Koppel. And along those lines, we know that, you know, Parent Aware, our quality rating system, really got a boost with money from the Race to the Top grant. Are we in line for any other additional federal funds? Because we know we're on the tail end of that grant money. Is there anything on the horizon that may help provide more funds for Parent Aware?
Madam Chair and members, the only thing that there's nothing specific to the additional from the Race to the Top money. Along with the reauthorization of the block grant, there was a slight increase in the formula, which I believe I'm going to go from memory, and I hate to do that, but I think it's around $4 million additional dollars to the state. But that is to also cover the licensure as well as other requirements. So, you know, in a sense, there's a small portion perhaps of that that we might be able to take, but specifics to Parent Aware and expanding our high-quality efforts, I'm not aware of any other money at this time.
All right, thank you. And then just to the broader question of child care in the costs, and we informed the committee about the CCAP rates and kind of our history there. But we also know that Minnesota is one of the highest cost states in the nation for child care, which seems to be a little out of whack with some of our other living expenses and how we stack up with other states. Have you been able to identify what some of those factors are, and is there anything that we can and should be doing to look at those issues that affect affordability for parents for quality child care?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great question, and I'm not an expert in that field personally, and I'm not prepared today to necessarily be able to answer your question well. I would say that my biggest concern in the early childhood is that it is a viable profession. Sometimes if you look at the cost of child care, most commonly is informal child care, but you know, the family, friend, and neighbor. The next is family child care providers, and then there's center-based providers. We have a growth in center-based. We have a shrinkage of family child care, and also a shrinkage in informal child care. Obviously, center-based is more expensive. However, I also want to balance that with this concern that nationally, we don't have a strong workforce in early childhood. You know, people who go get a degree and are actually professional early childhood instructors who really understand brain science and child development. And that's so important to get our kids off to the right start. There's so much brain science out now and so many wonderful things that we know we can do with our youngest children developmentally and preparing them for school. So I'm torn between the fact that it's expensive and the fact that it needs to be viable to make a living and to keep the workforce that we have. So I didn't answer your question. I only put it in a different frame, perhaps.
Well, I appreciate your comments on that. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering if Commissioner Casillas would come up to the table as well.
Thank you. Hopefully nobody got the really low, saggy chair. We have a few of those, and I apologize.
I can see me.
Representative Hertas drove the short straw today. Someday we'll have new chairs. Representative Grecia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming back up. And I just wanted to bring this up, Assistant Commissioner Koppel, thank you as well. But I wanted to take this opportunity. We've been working a lot with child protection, Representative Mullery, and early childhood. And what I was actually looking for, and I wanted to press the issue a little bit, something that I know Assistant Commissioner Koppel has heard me say, as well as the MD, how can we start to do data sharing better to identify these kids? I know we've all had it on our mind, and I guess what I'm putting you on notice to do is, how do we really start that conversation, really push the issue so that we can, instead of talking about programs all the time and trying to cast a wide net, to really identify the kids and agree upon where we're going to go and then broaden out from there. And I'm looking for efforts that you already have. I know yesterday we had a great meeting with the department, with DHS, as well as MDE and parent. We're looking at the demographics and culture and trying to capture that. How about this next step? And I'm just looking forward to the conversation.
Who wants to go first? Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Grecia, I think it's really a great opportunity. I was just at a preschool event with the Lieutenant Governor and Governor and some of the Dakota County commissioners, and they were talking about the data sharing and the work that they're doing in South St. Paul, and just amazing work that they're doing with families. And they said if we had better sharing agreements. I think one thing, and I was at a meeting a couple years ago with District 287 in Hennepin County commissioners, and we were talking about if there's a way to have families sign a waiver for, you know, who are getting county services or other services, and can we develop a form for that so that families, you know, choose to share data. Certainly the work on the back end of having to get our data sharing agreements among us, but engaging families up front I think is something that can be done right now if they agree to that sharing. But that's also very cumbersome and challenging. So we're committed to trying to find ways to navigate this because we know that having this kind of information is really good, but also at the same time protecting the rights of families and children as much as we possibly can.
Right, and Commissioner Koppel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Grecia, we have talked about this a lot, and I just yesterday was talking with Bobby Burnham, runs the Office of Early Learning, mm-hmm. I believe, at the Department of Education, and we are having that discussion, she reminded me, because I was late getting back to her, on that very issue of data sharing and talking about the possibility of child protection information being combined with some other early childhood information so that we had a more centralized database, which we are now going to have that discussion. These things don't happen as quickly. It takes time on these data sharing arrangements to make sure everything is within, maintains the privacy of the families and children involved. And I would also say this, I didn't say it at the beginning, that the Department of Education and Department of Health have been meeting around early childhood for about, going on a year now. In my time here, which has not been long, about 5 years in state service, this is the strongest initiative I've seen, and from what I've been told, the strongest we've had. And so we have some really great conversations, and we are having those kind of really out-of-the-box discussions to say, well, is this possible? How do we better coordinate child care and scholarships? We have infrastructure. I always say we have the infrastructure of the eligibility standards that go way back around child care. Scholarships have some great policy pieces to them to stay with the child right to kindergarten. But there's some great pieces to both, and we need to maximize it. So we're looking at a lot of different ways to improve outcomes for our youngest children.
Representative Grecia.
And thank you for that, Commissioner Casillas and Assistant Commissioner Koppel. And so I'll just put on, this will be my commercial for the day. I know this is going to be a political battle, and I'm willing to take that on. I also know when I talk to counties like Hennepin County, they've gone back and looked at the data and said, okay, we knew who these kids were. We just had them in different systems. And I know the water. I know the deep edge. But I think there's a coalition of legislators down here that are ready to take that battle on to say, yeah, we might be sharing a one-year-old Social Security number across multiple places, but the one-year-old doesn't really care. And they won't care if they're part of the achievement gap. So, I mean, I think we should start taking these head on. And, I mean, I know you're working on that. And I'm just giving a call out, and I notice that, yeah, let's actually do this. Let's push through those barriers. Let's push through those battles. And they'll be fun conversations. But they're very valuable.
All right, and Representative Mallory, I'm going to give you 1 minute because we have some additional testifiers and then another bill to get through. So.
Madam Chair, and I want to thank Representative Kreisha for bringing up the issue of sharing info because it's so extremely important. But I also did want to ask a question to them, whether, because I talked to the two people that answer FERPA questions for the feds, and they said it almost never gets in the way of anything, and it's really loose. It's almost always state law. And even the HIPAA usually is not the problem. So from the, we've got commissioners, assistant commissioners. Is it mostly the state law, like the feds say, or is it, are you having real trouble with HIPAA and FERPA, or is it mostly state law? Because Representative Kreisha and I are on task force that's really getting upset about lack of sharing.
Anyone want to take a crack? Commissioner Casalius.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it's a combination of all of it and really just how do you navigate all the laws around it and then kind of just navigating the politics of sharing Social Security numbers. As you know, we use a MARS number in for our enrollment and in capturing data, and we've been highly protective of sharing any kind of data, especially for our youngest children. So I think that we need to just continue to work through, like Representative Kreisha said, the barriers and the really the data privacy issues that do come up for very, very young children, and have some discussion about it. And that's what we're trying to do.
And Commissioner Koppel?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. And thank you to Representative Kreisha for continuing to encourage us to move forward on this. We were out, the three departments went out to the state of Washington on an early childhood effort. And we were exposed to their research approach to early childhood, which I thought was really fascinating, and I hope that at some point we could bring the head of that research unit out here and tell you about it. But they created an entity of 20 researchers that the state funds that have access to databases, all of them. And so there isn't a database that lives somewhere. It's a group of researchers who can access all the various databases and do research from that. So it assures that there's actual projects underway and outcomes that we're trying to figure out. And so it's a different way than going through all these data sharing agreements and trying to get through all. They created the actual researchers and just said, now go do the work. That group has now grown to 90 researchers because 70 of them are funded by other agencies who want research done on behalf of their agency around something. So, for instance, I'll stop with this, but I found this to be fascinating. We were all quite impressed and humbled by it. If you're not ready for kindergarten, through a kindergarten assessment that the state of Washington does, they can look back at that child and see where they went to preschool, where they were in child care, were they a premature birth baby, and look and see where is it, where are the connections between the experiences that a young child has and not being ready for school. And that's where we should spend our money or put our resources, because we can identify those through this. And I just thought that was such a smart approach to solving the problems that we're facing and doing it in a way where we're not violating confidentialities of kids. We're really looking at them in groups and clusters and looking at the experiences they had and going from those. So it's another way to approach the issue that definitely needs to be done.
Thank you. And with that, I think we should probably get to some of the rest of the members of the public who wish to testify, but I want to thank you all, commissioners, very much for being here. And I don't know if we've ever had commissioners from all these various agencies before the Education Finance Committee before. It's great to have you all here, really.
It shows how much we're working together.
That's a really good thing. Commissioner or Representative Christian wanted to know if we should have the IRS here too, and I said no. I have Melissa Sweetmilk, Dean of Students with Metro Deaf School, and Rebecca Swinney, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, a parent of a student at the Metro Deaf School, and I believe they have an interpreter with them as well. Right, so welcome to the committee, and if you would each just state your names as you begin your testimony. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Melissa Sweetmilk, and I am the Dean of Students at Metro Deaf School. I'm here to testify in support of the Parent Choice Bill that allows children of preschool and pre-K age of deaf and hard of hearing children to be enrolled at the school of their choice. Metro Deaf School is a local charter school in St. Paul, Minnesota. We have about 100 students, deaf and hard of hearing students. Currently, all of them have the label of special ed and qualify for deaf hard of hearing. We serve 25 different school districts around the metro area. With this bill, I'm hoping to reduce the barriers that parents experience when choosing a good fit for their deaf and hard of hearing child in education. There are many different options for deaf education, of course. You have oral, you have speaking and listening, you have mainstream with an interpreter, self-contained classrooms, or a school like a deaf school where ASL and English is our method of instruction. But we still have districts that do refuse to place their deaf and hard of hearing preschool students at our school. Really, before the age of 5 is critical learning time for children in their language. Can you imagine your own child not having access to language before the age of 5 because they couldn't be placed in a program that fit their learning needs? Metro Deaf School is still getting students that are very language delayed and they couldn't come into our program before age 5. They'll transfer in at kindergarten, second, even seventh grade with significant language delays. Parents of hearing children have a number of options. They have the parent choice. They have all these options of different charter schools, public schools. And options, that's what makes education great in the state of Minnesota. And parents of hard of hearing and deaf children before the age of 5, they don't have those same options right now. So we're hoping that you will support this bill and support the spirit of the parent education, parent choice law.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Becky Swinney, and I'm here in support of the bill that allows parents of young children, especially preschool age, to place their child in the program of their choosing. My son Carter is currently in the sixth grade at Metro Deaf School. When we found out he was deaf, we weren't sure what type of education setting would be best for him. When he was 2, he started Northern Voices, which is an oral program in St. Paul. He did not do well in that environment, so we started to seek out other options. That's when we found Metro Deaf School. And we enrolled him in the early childhood program when he was just over 2.5. And this was the right fit for Carter. He was thriving in a school where he could use his natural language, which is American Sign Language. Those early years of language acquisition were crucial. He's gone from a small boy who had no language, no social skills, no peer group, to a smart young man at the top of his class. He loves math and science, has a large group of close friends, and we couldn't be more proud of him. And when it comes to deaf and hard of hearing children, there's no one size fits all for their education. What didn't work for Carter may work for other children. It's crucial that parents are given the power to choose what will work best for their child. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Winnie. We appreciate you being here. Representative Wills had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. More of a comment. I wanted to thank the testifiers for being here today. And the committee members may remember last year we were able to pass enabling legislation to allow students to go to the Metro Deaf School, but we failed to include the funding. And so I authored a bill, House File 2411, that would provide funding, and I was pleased to see that the governor included it in his bill. And just a comment and support to encourage the committee to pursue this as we put our bill together. Just realizing that parents know their children best, and to hear that the school districts are refusing children being able to go to the Metro Deaf School when parents believe that's the best option for their child, I believe is unacceptable. And so I'm hoping we can get this language passed and the funding passed so that children can go to this school. And so thank you for being here today and sharing your story.
Other questions? All right, I don't see any other questions. Thank you both very much for being here, and thank you for your testimony. Mary Gilbert with St. Paul Public Schools. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools, and I just want to add how supportive the school district is regarding several of the recommendations that are included in the governor's budget. Specifically, and we hoped it would have been a bigger chunk, but we're happy that it was included, the TD&E money for non-QCOMP districts. The money that was put aside, the $10 million and $2.5 million, specifically for the teacher recruitment. The district does have many paraprofessionals, many with bachelor's degree, that are anxious to get their teaching certificate. That will significantly improve our ability to have committed teachers that have worked with our students before, and the research on those programs is very positive as far as retention and student outcomes. We're also very supportive of the pre-K recommendation. As I've said before, we have had over 500 students on our waiting list, and as our demand has grown for the all-day program, we have tried to expand those programs to provide an all-day opportunity. In addition, we are supportive of the provisions in the Health and Human Services bill related to the child care initiatives that Commissioner Koppel talked about, as well as the family home visiting program. I think you've heard from many of the superintendents that serve many of our high-needs students with mental illnesses that providing some family supports is really critical if we're going to be able to serve those students in our school buildings.
All right. Thank you. Those were the people who had indicated they wanted to testify on the governor's bill. So my plan right now is we'll go to Representative Erickson's bill, House Bill 3066, the policy bill, and then and we have some testimony on that. If there's room after that, we'll allow members of the public who want to testify on either the governor's bill or the policy bill to come forward. And of course, these will be initiatives we'll be hearing again next week. So if anyone doesn't get their chance today, you will have another chance next week. So with that, Representative Erickson moves that House File 3066 be referred to Ways and Means, but it is the Chair's intention to lay it over for today. And welcome. Thank you, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. House File 3066, the policy provision that I will have addressed shortly by Ms. Larson, our nonpartisan House research, is a bill about innovation. It empowers schools. It empowers our parents. And we have great hopes that this will proceed much like it is today before you, probably with some additions, and of course there are always omissions, but we look forward to this being really good for our children, our teachers, our school leaders, our school boards, and of course always our parents. Part of this is a proposal from the Department of Education, and the rest of it proposals from the Education Policy Innovation Committee. And I've asked Ms. Larson to walk us through the bill.
All right, Ms. Larson, if you could provide us a brief walkthrough through the bill.
Madam Chair, members, As Representative Erickson indicated, this is the department bill with a number of additions as a result of the bill being heard in the Education Policy Committee. The majority of the additions appear in Article 2. There are several other additions in Articles 3 and 4. In other articles, the language is exactly as the department presented it and as both the Education Policy and Education Finance Committees heard it. So in House File 3066, the first engrossment, Article 1 is entirely as the department presented it in the initial bill. Article 2 on page 2, section 1, is a provision proposed by Representative Erickson. It is a technical change only. Section 2 is an amendment proposed by Representative Erickson. It's to honor Constitution Day, which might include a number of different provisions, including a civics test. Section 3 is from MDE. Section 4 is from MDE. 5 and 6 are also from MDE. Section 7 is a proposal from Representative Bennett to identify MCA scores that indicate career and college readiness. Section 8 is from the department. Section 9, Section 10. Section 11 and Section 12, although there is a change on page 15 in Subdivision 2, there is a clarification which the Policy Committee inserted to indicate that the data collected under the World's Best Workforce would remain non-public data until the Commissioner releases it. Section 13 is an amendment offered by Representative Erickson having to do with a Montessori license through the 2018-2019 school year. Section 14 is from the department. 15 is from the department. 16 and 17 are from the department. There are a number of sections here from the department making technical changes to refer to a World's Best Workforce Plan instead of an Educational Improvement Plan. This includes sections 18, 19, 20, 21. Section 22 is from the department on staff development. Section 23 is from the department. 24 is from the department. 25 is from the department. Section 26 is a bill Representative Erickson introduced listing a number of the statutory provisions on parent rights. Section 27 is an amendment from Representative Mariani having to do with the biennial surveys of teacher shortages throughout the state. Section 28 is a result of a bill Representative Lucero authored and Representative Erickson amended pertaining to student survey instruments. Section 29 is from the department. Section 30 is one of three sections Representative Ward introduced having to do with the Perfect Center for Arts Education. Section 31 is the second of the Ward provisions on the Perfect Center. Section 32 is the second of the two sections from Representative Bennett having to do with career and college-ready MCA benchmarks. Section 33 is a bill that Representative Peterson introduced and Representative Erickson amended having to do with innovation zones. Section 34 is a bill that both Representative Erickson and separately Representative Mariani introduced establishing a legislative study group to look at the OLA recommendations on teacher licensing. Section 35 is the second of the two sections in Representative Erickson's proposal on the legislative study group. Section 36 is a bill from Representative Erickson directing the department to work on data security, on a data security plan. Section 37 is the last of the three sections from Representative Ward on the Perfect Center. Section 38 is from the Erickson Amendment to the Peterson Bill on Innovation Zones, calling for the provision to be codified in the 2016 statutes. Section 39 has repealers. Many of them were from MDE. There is also a repealer of the Principals Leadership Academy, mindful of appropriations for this purpose in the 2015 Education Finance Bill. And that, Madam Chair, is Article 2. Article 3 is as MDE proposed it, with the exception of Sections 1 and 2, which are proposals from Representative Barrett. They have to do with authorization applications and school district authorizers specifically. Section 4 is almost entirely language from the department. There are two small technical changes in Sections 1 and 4 referring to a transition plan. And finally, Section 8, which was a proposal or a bill from Representative Erickson on the deaf and hard of hearing advisory committees. The remainder of the bill, the remaining articles, are all language as proposed by the department.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Larson. Representative Erickson, did you want to make any overall comments about your bill before we go to testifiers?
Well, I would like to call attention to the fact that I think the Bennett proposal using the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment as a way to guide our students as they prepare for a career or college. It will help inform families, students, and teachers about student preparation. We believe, at least I do, that it's very important to use an instrument that has been designed by Minnesota teachers, Minnesota parents, and our personnel in our assessment department of the Minnesota Department of Education, and hold that up as a very responsible way to guide our children through their education. It also attempts to limit remedial coursework for those who achieve this college-ready score, so that we are not sending so many of our students to college to take courses for which they will get no credit, but they must pay tuition. We're also very proud of a jump start to fix our broken teacher licensure process. A study group or task force, whichever it turns out to be, I think is the way to look at all of the issues that the Board of Teaching has the Office of Legislative Auditor has brought forward to us in regard to the Board of Teaching and the Licensing Division at the Department of Education. And then a security management and access of student data plan, which we think will work very well with what the department is in the process of doing right now. The innovation zones now codified and offering more opportunities in career and technical education rather than going down the path of authentic testing, which was the original proposal from Representative Peterson. A parents' rights section taken from the education code that will help guide our parents. And finally, of course, a micro civics Dean Erdahl light bill that I have placed in there to honor the U.S. Constitution and the civics test that's become so popular among us by looking at what's called Constitution and Citizenship Day in the United States of America, typically on September 17th, but we haven't named a date because sometimes that date falls on a Saturday or Sunday. With that, Madam Chair, that's kind of the highlights of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. I think, why don't we go ahead and hear from our testifiers who have asked to speak so we get those remarks in, and then we'll go to questions. So I'm going to call you down, and then if you want to kind of just be close by, Christine Twait with Partners in Nutrition, and then we've got some people from the Purpich Center, three, Martha Weaver-West, Stephen Daly, and Susan Mao Larson. And then Mr. Jimenez with the Minnesota Council of Latino Affairs. So why don't we start with Christine Twait. And welcome. And if you would please just state your name before you begin your remarks.
Sure, Madam Chair and members of the board. I'm Christine Twait. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit organization called Partners in Nutrition. And I'm here today to request that House File 3066 be amended to address the procedures used by the MDE and its administration of the USDA Child and Adult Care Food Program, which I'll call the food program, to spare you from the acronyms. The food program is a USDA child nutrition program that's designed to feed hungry children and seniors in Minnesota. The food program provides funds to programs that care for youth and seniors so they can afford nutritious meals and snacks. Family daycare homes, child care centers, after-school programs, homeless shelters, and adult daycare centers are all eligible to receive food program funds. The food program is administered by the MDE. All funds for the food program come from the federal government, so Minnesota does not provide any funding for the food program. The food program is underutilized in Minnesota, especially among programs serving low-income communities and communities of color. The best estimates are that there are 294 child care centers in the metropolitan area alone that could be accessing funds, which amounts to 5.6 million meals and $4.8 million in additional federal funds that could be coming to Minnesota. The USDA recognizes that programs caring for low-income communities need help with the food program, and they've authorized the creation of sponsors to assume the administrative burdens. So sponsors provide training and technical assistance to the programs, and sponsors devote resources to developing culturally appropriate materials that help English language learners and those with limited formal education to understand all of the rules. Minnesota needs more sponsors of the food program. Minnesota has one sponsor of independent child care centers, two non-school district sponsors of after-school programs, zero sponsors of adult daycare, and zero sponsors of homeless shelters. The reason that there are not more sponsors is in part because the MDE process to become a sponsor is fraught with procedural barriers that are not imposed in other states, and we believe to be out of alignment with federal regulations. The federal regulations that govern the food program state that the application process should take a maximum of 30 calendar days. MDE has put a pre-application process in place that dramatically lengthens the process. It took us 64 days to get through the pre-application process, an additional 83 days to get through the rest of the application process. In total, it took us 147 days to get through a process that is required by federal regulations to last no more than 30 days. MDE's process is out of compliance with our neighboring states also. The state of Illinois has their complete application materials on their website. When we contacted Iowa, we were told that we were automatically eligible to be a sponsor based on our 501c3 status, and we were offered friendly technical assistance. Partners in Nutrition application to be a food program sponsor was denied on the basis of financial viability. MDE declined to provide a clear definition of financial viability, and they also declined to provide written policies and procedures that they use to assess financial viability. We submitted several rounds of detailed budget information, and the financial viability of our organization was vouched for by a certified public accountant from a firm that specializes in financial viability assessments. After our denial, Partners in Nutrition consulted with centers to help them apply for food benefits on their own, and those centers have also experienced procedural barriers from MDE. I have several written statements from those centers. They were unable to testify today. So given our experience and that of our centers, I believe a legislative solution is needed. I specifically request that you amend House File 3066 to prohibit MDE from using a pre-approval process, to require MDE to immediately make available complete materials needed to apply, prohibit MDE from placing a limit on the number of sites a sponsor may have, and require MDE to define financial viability and make public their policies and procedures in assessing financial viability. So I ask you for your support for the inclusion of these provisions in order to help feed low-income children and seniors in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Twait. And we're going to hear from our testifiers from the Purpich Center, but if you would not go far away. Thank you. All right, and then the three people who wanted to testify regarding the Purpich Center, Ms. West, Mr. Daly, and Ms. Larson. Welcome to the committee, and please just state your name as you begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Martha Weaver West, and I am proud to serve as a volunteer director with the Purpich Center.
Good morning. Good afternoon. My name is Susan Mal Larson. I'm also very proud to serve as a member of the Purpich Center for the Arts Board of Directors.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to speak with you for a few moments about a couple of points on House File 3066, specifically Sections 30 and 31. We wanted to just bring to your attention some of the concerns that we have with those two sections that are a part of this bill. We are in the process of being audited by the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I first want you to know that we welcome the opportunity to be examined, to be scrutinized, and to improve based upon that scrutiny. And we feel at this time that the procedures that are being requested in these sections of the bill are a bit premature because of the legislative audit that will be taking place shortly. First, it declares that the board of the Purpose Center be reduced from 15 to 13 board members, requiring at least one school administrator or elected school board member, one professional artist, and one arts educator to serve on the board. We do have an elected school board member. That would be myself. I also serve as a school board member with the PACT Charter School in the city of Ramsey, so I am pleased to serve in that role. We also do have a professional artist also on our board, and that is Matthew Ollig, who has been a very valued member of our board for several years. And up until just about 6 months ago, we also had a professional educator, a professor of music from St. Olaf College in Northfield. It also requires the seven-member nominating committee composed of several different entities. This also, we feel, causes a conflict of interest in that the Minnesota State Arts Board also draws from the same pool of potential applicants. So we feel that it might be difficult for them to determine the applicants that are best for the Arts Board versus the applicants for the Purpose Center, and would appreciate greater scrutiny for that. And then also requires the Purpose Center board members to undergo governance training. I think this is a terrific idea for every other board member that I serve on. We receive basic education on governance. We've gone through the University of St. Thomas's School of Excellence in Governance, and so I think this is an excellent suggestion for our board. In regard to the Section 31 regarding public information, we can do better. Yes, we are focused on our terrific students and our wonderful educational staff, but we can and will do better in the area of public information and making sure that not only is information posted to the website, whether it is in regard to our agenda, our budget, our recent audits, our personnel, our goals, etc., but also making sure that we are examining our analytics to make sure that they are in the easiest way to be found on our website. So we appreciate the opportunity to continue to improve on a daily basis as we work with excellent educators across the state to improve arts curriculum, and through arts curriculum, improving science and math scores in proven methods. So thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Ms. Larson, and I presume this is Mr. Daly. And I will ask you both to be brief and try not to repeat, just because I know I have members with questions and we're getting close to time for today's.
Absolutely. So. Madam Chair and committee members, and actually what I was going to say is I am here to answer questions, and I will defer to my colleagues out of respect for your time.
Thank you.
Sure, I missed the beginning, but
if you please state your name for the record.
Yeah. The main gist of what we wanted to get across today.
I'm sorry, for the tape's purpose, I need you to say your name.
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't hear very well.
That's all right.
My name is Steve Daly. I'm a board member on Purpose Center for Arts Education.
Thank you.
The only thing that I had to add to this is that currently we're undergoing an audit at Purpose, a financial audit. And what we were concerned now that there is a second audit that's coming up also during the school year, and we feel that we're being stretched thin on our resources. And our feeling is shouldn't we be waiting for the results of an audit before we start implementing ideology into the process? So that's all I had to say in addition to whatever my colleague said.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here. Representative Murphy has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here today and testifying about House File 3066. My question doesn't exactly have to do with that, but last year we had quite a lengthy conversation about the Purpose School and their relationship with the schools in Faribault for the deaf and hard of hearing, and the connection for IT and technology. There was a bill, a Daniels bill for IT, and I was wondering, and this bill doesn't address that, and that bill didn't get funded, and but I want to know what your relationship today is with the schools in Faribault for the blind and the deaf and the hard of hearing.
Madam Chair, Representative Ms. Murphy, I am sorry I cannot answer your question, but I will find out and make sure you have an answer this afternoon. But I can say we continue to struggle at Purpich with technology because we are preparing our students to be successful contributors in the community, and that in a lot of cases with graphic design and visual mediums, it's based in a Mac environment. And unfortunately, in the state of Minnesota, we are a state agency, and that is a Windows environment. So we continue to struggle and try and find unique ways to satisfy our technology needs to best serve our students.
Thank you. Did you either of the other two have a comment on that? Okay. Representative Murphy? Thank you. All right. Representative Wills, I know you had a question. Is it of these testifiers or other?
Oh, from this week.
Okay. Then Representative Newton?
Let me ask just a brief question. It probably goes to Mr. Strom. Are we as prescriptive in determining the board of directors for other schools, for example, Faribault School or any of the others? Is that in statute, you know, for all of our schools that are sort of non-traditional K-12 schools in terms of the board of directors?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, we do have a specific chapter of statute related to Purpich currently. So since its formation, its board has been prescribed by the statute. Other organizations like Faribault, there are requirements for the way that works as well. And I can provide you with those. The Purpich and Faribault are both fairly unique and offhand. I can't think of a third organization like those two in terms of being a K-12 some portion of K-12 provider with a separate board.
Madam Chair, I was thinking of the School for Deaf, the Metro School for Deaf also. Oh,
and Madam Chair, Representative Newton, that is a charter school. The Metro Deaf School is prescribed in the same manner as all other charter schools and has the flexibility that charter schools do to establish their board membership.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions for these particular testifiers? All right. Thank you all very much for being here. And I have Mr. Jimenez with the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs who had asked to testify. Welcome. And if you would please just state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Hi, my name is Henry Jimenez. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. The Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs is here to support House File 3066 for many of the highlights that Representative Erickson has already stated, so I won't iterate those. But we do want to bring some attention to what our council believes that the inclusion of ethnicities, nationalities, and other factors in the disaggregation and cross-tabulation of student data is an important step towards addressing the needs of Latino and other students in the state. Currently, the data used to identify students does not accurately identify them. Latinos and other ethnic diverse groups do not come in a one-size-fits-all mold, which many of you are very much aware of that. For example, educational support services needed by limited English proficiency Mexican descent students are not the same as students with learning disabilities of Puerto Rico descent. Spanish-speaking Afro-Latino populations might not be identified as Latino. In southern Minnesota, for example, we have a significant number of Guatemalans who don't speak Spanish. Again, these are just examples. With more accurate and detailed data, all student groups will receive more focused attention and the right support needed to succeed. We believe that the author amendments, which were by Representative Erickson, are a positive step forward, and we support them. We would like to see the bill take the disaggregation of data further, but this is a good start. Our agency had the opportunity to meet with Minnesota Department of Education, MNCAN, to discuss the level of data disaggregation we think is important. We understand that the hesitation and limitations due to some changes that will be coming from the federal government and potential further costs and other factors. However, we look forward to continue to work with MDE, MNCAN, and Representative Erickson and others in furthering the impact of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jimenez. I appreciate it. Any questions for the folks who testified? And I'm sorry, Representative Wills, and you wanted to comment, and you had a question for Ms. Twait?
Yes, if Ms.
If she's here, if you want to come back down to the testifier table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in listening to your testimony, I heard you say that the department failed to provide clear policy and procedures.
Yes.
In the application process. And I was just wondering if you could briefly elaborate on that and what you meant by that.
Ms. Twait.
Madam Chair, Representative, the Department of Education is required by federal regulations to assess the financial viability of sponsoring organizations. They have policies and procedures in place for organizations that have been in existence for more than 3 years, for example, by looking at audited financial statements. Our organization is approximately a year old. We did not have audited financial statements, and there was no policy or procedure put in place for how we could demonstrate our financial viability.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be all right if I quickly asked Assistant Commissioner Corte to explain what the policy and procedures are and whether they are public or how any organization would be able to access them?
Yes. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Corte. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, Darren Cordy from Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education. Representative Wills, thank you for your question. Ms. Twait's correct that typically we would look at typically organizations that apply for sponsorship have been in existence for a specified amount of time, so we can go back and look at their financial performance in the past and determine whether or not they have financial viability moving forward. In this case, as she said, there were no abilities for them to demonstrate financial viability using past performance since they were a new entity. So we worked with them closely over time to develop financial projections that they submitted to us. We went through and revised those projections a number of times based upon actual numbers that we had. And based on those projections, we were not able to determine that they would be financially viable going forward. So those are what the policies and procedures are that we worked with them to determine what those what their financial abilities would be going forward. And based on those, we were not able to approve them under the federal regulations.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Corte. I appreciate you going through that. So it sounds like there's nothing to go by because this is not something that's done typically for a new organization. And would it be fair to say that you had to come up with the policy and procedure as you went along for this particular situation?
Commissioner Corday.
Madam Chair and Representative Wills, no, the regulations clearly state what financial viability means, and there is guidance from the USDA that we have provided to partners in nutrition that explains the criteria that we need to use to determine financial viability. While we haven't approved an organization in this situation before, it was a bit of a learning experience for us and for them, but to say that we were just kind of doing it as we went along, I don't think would be accurate either, as we had the federal regulations to rely upon.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how many organizations have been approved in this process?
Commissioner Gordon.
Madam Chair and Representative Wills, I know that Ms. Twait mentioned the sponsorship numbers. I don't know if what she said was accurate. I don't have them in front of me, but I'd be happy to give you the number of sponsoring organizations we have here in this state.
I would appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Thank you. All right. Ms. Korda, if you would just send that to the committee and we'll make sure everyone receives that information.
Yes, ma'am.
Much appreciated. Thank you. All right. Members, here's the proposal I have for you. How many members of the public in the audience right now would like to testify on either the governor's bill or the policy bill, House File 3066? Just show of hands. Okay. So... then I think Representative Ward, if you wanted to testify now, that would be great, because otherwise my other proposal is we come back at 5:30 and take more testimony. So welcome, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you briefly about the perpetrage portion of the omnibus bill. This came to my attention after my work on preserving and saving the Crosswinds School several years ago. And the parents and students and the staff have stayed in touch with me and encouraged me to help. And I did mostly encourage them to be patient with the transition as Perpich took over the responsibility. They actually managed the school in 2013 for that school year. But we didn't do the conveyance until 2014. In the meantime, patience has run thin because the schools are failing. The administration is not being successful with the students, with the programs. They're not actually fulfilling the mandate of 129C.10 that was establishing the Perpich Center for the Community, Center of the Arts. And Perpich is the whole center for arts education was designed 31 years ago or so to serve the entire state. They are not being successful at doing that. They're cutting programs significantly. I'm really concerned about the arts education in the state and how that can be sustained if we don't do something faster. I actually have support from the Office of the Legislative Auditor to go ahead and do our bill, that the recommendations that are in the bill would be the first things that they would have the organization do. So they actually said it would just give them a head start on what they're supposed to do anyway. And the bill addresses some shortcomings in the original legislation that does not hold the organization accountable as other state agencies are. So I'm concerned about the state agency aspect of it. I'm concerned about the educational aspect of it. And I have an array of testifiers who will come next week and in support of this portion of your omnibus bill. If we wait, we run the risk of a lot more damage and a lot more people who are hurting. And Minnesota Music Association, for instance, Music Teachers Association, has not had the service that they are mandated to receive from Perpich. It's just not being managed well, and we really need to address these things sooner rather than later. The legislative auditor will do an audit, but it would be a year before we could act on it. So I would encourage you to ask me questions. We can talk later. I'd be happy to talk with any of you and give you a lot of evidence about why this needs to happen now. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you, Representative Ward. Any questions for Representative Ward right now? And obviously, feel free. She's invited you all to speak with her offline as well. All right. Seeing none. All right. Then we won't need to come back tonight since I didn't see a show of hands of people needing to testify. Thank you. It is Thursday. And it will be a busy week next week. So I thank the committee, and we are adjourned.